For the week of May 20th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 148, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, this is J. Sperling Reich.
And I guess in New York City, which sounds a little lame compared to Cannes, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, I mean, I think that it depends on what you're doing in New York City. It doesn't have to be lame. New York is one of the best cities in the world.
Yeah, but, you know, after 12 years, 11 years in a row at Cannes, I'm sort of missing the festival.
Well, I believe if you listen to last week's episode, you'll know why Michael is staying home this year. But yes, I'm in Cannes, and I can brief you on all the films and everything that you think you're missing.
Oui.
And really, that's all we have for this week, because I didn't have time to do show notes because I've been running around and doing other work here. And you've also been traveling.
So I was in Alabama. Yeah, I just got back to New York. Drove overnight, arrived at 5 in the morning.
Wow. Okay. And that's why you said as we were prepping the show that you were falling asleep.
That's right.
Well, we don't want to put our audience to sleep. So, you know, usually we have a whole bunch of topics that we'll cover in every single episode. This week, it's just going to be Cannes. Of course, we do have some big deal or big whoop. It's a truncated big deal or a big whoop where we'll go over some...
Stop apologizing.
Okay,
we're world travelers. Keep going.
You know, the one thing that has not changed, we always start with entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who fills us in on the weekend's box office. So take it away, Michael.
And the number one movie around the world yet again is Marvel's The Avengers, which grossed another $111 million worldwide. It's at $1.18 billion total. It's Disney's biggest worldwide hit of all time. It's the number four hit of all time. It needs another $160 million to pass HP7P2, Harry Potter Part 7 Part 2, in order to become the third biggest hit of all time. It will do that in 2 weeks or three at the most.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
And it is. And I guess it's slowing down, and I guess it's not going to hit 2 billion. But, you know, boy, movies make money fast. So it's kind of hard sometimes to judge how long the legs will be. But this is a movie that's obviously one of the biggest hits of all time. And number two around the world is The Dictator, Sacha Baron Cohen's new comedy. It grossed $47 million worldwide on a movie that may have cost $65 million to make, or maybe $100 million, depending on who you speak with. And number three around the world is Dark Shadows, the Tim Burton Johnny Depp comedy. That grossed another $43 million worldwide. It's at $117 million total. Not great for a movie that cost about $150 million to make. It's a rare commercial stumble for Burton and Depp. And number four around the world, the movie I saw this weekend, Battleship, starring Taylor Kitsch. It opened in the U.S. after opening overseas a few weeks early. It grossed $32 million around the world. It's at $252 million and slowing fast. At number five around the world is What to Expect When You're Expecting, a romantic comedy that made $10.5 million in its debut. In North America, it hit number five, just like it is around the world. And number six is the American Pie movie American Reunion. That grossed another $10 million around the world. I'm still puzzled as to why this has been such a big hit overseas. It grossed $216 million worldwide.
I think I can answer that question because, you know, normally...
Didn't you a few weeks ago?
Well, I don't know. Did I? I guess maybe
yeah,
we did.
Yeah, we talked about it and you felt like it had been set up by the earlier movies, but it's been so long, I'm still surprised.
Well, but I also think that, you know, normally comedies don't do well overseas. So English-speaking comedies don't do well in, say, France or Germany because then everything has to be translated and it's not always funny. However, American Pie, there are so many, sight gags that I think it works.
So The Three Stooges will be the biggest comedy hit of the year.
Well, one would think, but I don't necessarily know that the Three Stooges were as big overseas as they were in the U.S.
Neither was American Pie until this movie. At number seven around the world is our old friend, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which I haven't seen yet. It grossed $5 million, basically in North America. It's at $87 million worldwide and counting. I couldn't find any overseas grosses for it, just a little bit, about $1.8 million, it looks like, from the rest of the world. So that has grossed $87 million, doing very well indeed. And number eight, opening in France only, is Rust and Bone, the latest film from the director of Un Prophète, which debuted at Cannes and has now opened in France. It grossed $4.6 million, putting it at number eight around the world. And number nine is The Lucky One, the Zac Efron drama. It grossed $4 million, and it's at $83 million and counting. And number 10 is The Hunger Games, the massive hit from earlier this year. It grossed $3 million, and it's at $500 million worldwide. And finally, number 11 is Think Like a Man, the movie that probably won't even open up overseas, but it grossed another $2.7 million, and it's at $85 million and counting.
Well, you know, Rust and Bone actually it's here in Cannes. It's one of the competition films. So it must
That's what I said.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It And you know, it's also a film, I guess we can talk about that now. Well, why don't we hold off on talking about that, because I was a little surprised. We'll stick with box office for a second. I was surprised that you didn't mention that Battleship really it tanked. It opened in the U.S., and people could not wait to say how bad this movie was and how badly it was doing at the box office.
Well, I saw it opened in the North America at $25 million. Not great. They were hoping to $35 to $40 million. It's a big, expensive movie. Cost $200 million to make. The director, Peter Berg, is a growing force in the industry. He's done some very good movies like Friday Night Lights. Taylor Kitsch, of course, starred in the TV version of Friday Night Lights. He was in John Carter of Mars, or officially just John Carter, earlier this year. Disney's claimed that's going to be a $200 million write-down. Now, a few months later, he has another big, huge movie that's also another pretty much a flop. Battleship. It's at $250 million, and Universal says they're going to have to write down $150 million off this movie. So it's been a bad 3 months for Taylor Kitsch. On the plus side, he is starring the new Oliver Stone film, Savages, and he does have a role in Peter Berg's next film. So, you know, he's still got a few more at-bats before his career stops completely. But I saw the movie. I didn't think it was that bad. It was dumb. It was stupid, of course. I've seen just as plenty dumb mindless movies make tons of money around the world. So, you know, I'm not quite sure anyone would have the long knives out for it. It was certainly not good, but, you know, dumb, harmless, Top Gun type stupidity.
Well, you know, I don't necessarily know that you could blame Battleship on Taylor Kitsch. I don't think he's getting...
I don't at all, but...
Yeah.
It doesn't help to be in two big franchise, potential franchises, the lead, and they both flop. That's not going to help him. They both made some money overseas, you know, $200 million plus, so he's obviously not driving people away, but, you know, it's not a fun 2 months for him, that's for sure.
No, that is true.
I'll tell you, though, this movie gave me the biggest laugh of the year, though. This is literally a Top Gun type movie, a dumb, dumb, stupid, rah-rah military, go U.S., shameless popcorn flick with, you know, with paraplegic vets, you know, coming to the fore, old veterans coming back from the past to help defeat aliens. Everybody works together. It's as wholesome and go U.S. military you could ask for. And at the end of the movie, they're at the happy finale. I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that the world isn't destroyed. But anyway, there's a big happy finale, even though some people are lost on the way. Big happy finale. And what's the song that they immediately dive into for the credit sequence? It's Creedence Clearwater's Revival's Fortunate Son, which, if you know the song at all, is this diatribe against rah-rah patriotism and how people will say, hey, they'll raise the flag and send you off to war, but their children get to stay home. It's not in any way, shape, or form an appropriate song for the end of this movie. It's one of the worst choices I have ever heard in a film for a song to end a movie. It's just mind-boggling. I can't believe CCR would even allow it because it's so completely opposite to what the song is about. It's kind of stunning and hilarious and stupid.
Well, first of all, they may not own the rights to that song, and therefore
publishing people should not have sold. I'm not saying Creedence doesn't exist as a band. John Fogerty famously does not own the rights to a song, but when you have a great song, to let it be used in a context that completely undermines the song is a little stupid.
Well, I guess it just goes to show you the thought process that was going on when they were making that movie. There was little of it.
Very telling. I'm a little shocked that people say The Dictator, the Sacha Baron Cohen movie, which I thought probably had a decent opening at $45 million or $47, I should say.
That's pretty good, because if you think about it, that film will probably top out between $90 and $120 million, somewhere in there.
Well, but that's not great, because people are saying it cost $100 million after reshoots. I thought Sacha Baron Cohen's comedy would be a cheap $30 million movie, but they say it costs $100 million, and officially it's $65 million. That's still a lot. For his type of movie, that's a lot of money, I think. Where the heck's the money? It's just a dumb, cheap comedy.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure a good chunk of it goes to him.
I mean, he's going to get a piece of the profits. He doesn't need upfront, you know, he's the man. So, you know, why would the movie cost $100 million? It's bizarre.
Yeah, well, it made 17.4 in the U.S. I don't know whether that's being seen as kind of a good sign, given that it was released on 3,000 screens. That's a lot of screens to be released on to only make $17 million.
I don't think anybody cares about the number of screens per se. That just lets theater people get off on per screen averages. It's not a great opening. It's not a disaster. I doubt the word of mouth would be tremendous. It looks dumb. But, you know, if it costs $65 million to make and it opens at $47 million, it better have good legs or it's going to be in trouble.
Well, you know, 9 weeks into its run, The Hunger Games is still making money. $3 million in the U.S. this past week. That's pretty amazing. That's pretty good.
It is by far the movie longest run in the top 10 or top 11. You know, no other movie has been out for more than 5 weeks. So, yeah, you don't see legs like that every day. But you know, it's a good movie with a lot of demand, and you know, 9 weeks should not be that much of a surprise anymore. But I guess it is. After 9 weeks, it's about to come out on DVD, right?
Well, 12 weeks.
I mean, yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, and the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, I think the reason that you can't find any other international grosses for that other than in North America is because I think it's played out everywhere else but North America.
Right, it's mostly played out. It made about $1.8 million overseas, but it is, in fact, mostly played out.
Yeah, and you know that's kind of going to be happening more and more. What Hollywood is realizing is that when 60% of your box office comes from overseas, hey, that's probably where you should start.
Well, I don't know if it's, you should start it. Just, you know, it's a movie-by-movie basis. A lot of big movies will open roughly around the same time, like The Avengers. You know, 3 days here, 5 days there is really essentially a simultaneous release. A small movie like Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, they had huge British stars. You know, Maggie Smith and Judi Dench are huge draws in the UK. Any play they star in sells out, literally sells out. So when they have them in a movie that's geared towards adult audience, it made sense to open it in the UK first because that's where they're going to have their best strike at the box office, and that's where they can sell their story around the world. And it's not a movie you want to open in 80 countries, obviously.
Speaking of movies opening, I was on my way here to Cannes to attend the festival, and I noticed that some of the films like Police, which showed last year at the festival, are just now making their way to the U.S., so it took an entire year for some of these films to make it from the Croisette here in Cannes all the way to the U.S. and onto the big screen there.
Well, I wouldn't say that. You say that as if it's odd or bizarre, but it's, in fact, very normal for a movie that debuts at Cannes to take a year or longer or two or even three to come to North America or almost anywhere, really. These are not movies necessarily geared towards big commercial launches. They're oftentimes very much art films that don't have distributors yet or, you know, anywhere beyond their home country. So the fact that Police took a year to come to the U.S. is perfectly normal.
Yeah, well, this year there was a lot of presale action before the festival even started. And speaking
of... You mean big movies playing in the festival were picked up by people around the world?
Yes, correct. And specifically for the U.S. I know Weinstein brought a couple of films. And now you're going to ask me which ones, and I can't remember.
But well, first, let's talk about you're at Cannes, and the weather's been horrible from what I hear.
Oh, my goodness. Normally, Cannes is, you know, south of France. It's on the Riviera. The Mediterranean Sea is right here, and it's beautiful. It's sunny. It's warm.
And the women are topless. Not that you would know because you're married.
Well, not that I would know because I'm in a movie theater. But and thank goodness I'm in a movie theater most of the day because, let's face it, as you say, it's absolutely poured here for 4 or 5 straight days.
Rain, rain, rain. One of the... temporary homes where they show theater, where they show films. It's not a permanent building, but a tent that they set up where they have next day screenings of some movies. That tent, that, which is a very big, elaborate theater screening room, really actually collapsed. The roof collapsed, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it started to leak. And then, yeah, there was basically a big tent, as you say. And of course, too much water filled up the roof and part of it collapsed. And they had it up and open again the next day.
But no one was hurt, obviously.
No, nobody was hurt. Although, I'll tell you, it makes me kind of leery to go in there during the rain. But this is not a festival that is set up for rain. I mean, they make people line up outside the Debussy, as you know. They also make people line up outside the Grand Lumiere. These are the two biggest theaters here in Cannes that, where films are shown. And so people are lining up outside sometimes for an hour, hour and a half before a film. And to do that in the rain with an umbrella and then to try and make your way in this queue to with all the umbrellas open to show your badge and get into a screening is very, very difficult. And then, of course, you're walking across marble floors as soon as you enter the Palais des Festivals, which is where most of these films are shown.
So you're at the festival, you're seeing some great movies, and in a year or 6 months or 2 years from now, we're going to be looking forward to seeing them. What movie should I most be anticipating that you've seen so far? What movie has got the biggest buzz, the one that should be really excited about catching?
Do you want to start there or do you want to start...
Whatever you want to do.
Okay. Well, I would say, you know, let's keep in mind that last year, Tree of Life won the Palme d'Or, the top prize here at the festival, and it was nominated for an Academy Award.
And it was my favorite film of the year.
And some of the stars were nominated as well. And, of course, also The Artist was shown here, and that won Best Picture last year.
I wouldn't say, I mean, normally Cannes does not send movies right to the Oscars. So, you know, it's a very important festival for prestige and for Europe. I don't think it really helps the movie box office-wise in North America, not usually. And I think the last year was a bit of a fluke. But certainly they get great films, and there's there are certainly, for people who love movies, there are always going to be a couple movies that are going to be among the best of the year that you see when you're at Cannes. They're not usually a force at the Oscars, but there you go.
If they're a force, it's more in the acting categories than best picture categories. You know,
sometimes,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. You know, and down the street, they have all of these sidebars. So down the street, the director's fortnight or the Cannes de Rielet, you know what? I shouldn't even have tried.
Don't even try. There's hundreds of movies playing in the festival. Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to mention two from the director's fortnight. No, which stars Gael Garcia Bernal, who he is in Pablo Larraín's No. He stars as a Chilean ad executive who in the 1980s helped topple the Pinochet dictatorship. And the interesting thing about this, first of all, everybody loves the film. Secondly, I mean, it's supposed to be one of the best films here. It was shot entirely on period equipment. So all of this U-matic video camera. So it has a very interesting...
What's U-matic?
U-matic is just the videotape, the type of videotape that was used.
Used in the 80s?
In the 1980s, yes.
Well, that's kind of cool. So it's retro cool. Instead of shooting with an iPhone, you're shooting with the video camera footage that you would have at the time. So does it sort of have a faux documentary feel about it? Why is it?
Precisely. And it's got that gritty, kind of grainy, you know, it's not HD. It's like less than standard def practically.
Well, I love Gael García Bernal. Obviously, he's a terrific actor. And Sony Classics picked that up. So that will certainly be opening in North America sometime down the road.
Yeah. Another film creating buzz at the fortnight is Room 237, which is this documentary that kind of goes into all of these theories about...
Oh, that's The Shining.
Yes, the Stanley Kubrick film. They kind of say, well, what are all the hidden messages in it? And there's all these... There's about five different viewpoints that they explore, and they have voiceover to try and explain it. And it showed at Sundance and caused a big stir there, and it's being shown here in the director's fortnight, once again causing a big stir. And I believe it's already picked up and will be released in the United States already.
Well, one of the things I love to do at Cannes is see the longest movie I can find at the festival. And I'm not sure what that is yet this year, but certainly one of the longer movies that played is Lawrence Anyways by director Xavier Dolan, who's I've interviewed and is a terrific talent. That was in the Uncertain Regards section. It got a lot of play and attention. What is the buzz you've heard about that?
Not all of it good, I might add.
Of course. He's very polarizing, but people do say he's got flash and talent and looks like a Canadian Almodovar.
Yes, I mean, this one, people say, hey, look, he's 23 years old, he should not be making a movie that's 2 hours and 40 minutes, and I do believe that is one of the longest films in the festival.
Are you supposed to be 40 before you can make a movie that's 2 hours and 40 minutes long, or 60? How long do you have to be before you can make a long movie?
I have no idea.
I don't think they'd care if it was good.
That is absolutely correct, and I think that I read somewhere that, you know, that you should not make a movie that is more than five times your age. So technically, he could have only made a 100. He's like 23. He could only make
a 115-minute movie. Yeah,
151-minute movie. Yeah. So,
do you see it? Is it a mess?
I've not seen it, and what I've heard about it is not that it's necessarily a mess, but just that it's very self-indulgent. It looks beautiful. He's in love with himself. It's a story about two men who have a relationship, and one is getting a sex change, and
he doesn't star in it though.
He doesn't star in it?
No, he does not star in it, so he doesn't have a role in it.
Okay, I thought he did.
No, he does not.
So maybe when people were saying that he's in love with himself, they were talking about the way he was directing the film.
Or indulging himself, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Beasts of the Southern Wild also showed at Sundance. In fact, it won Sundance, and it was shown here in the Uncertain Regard category, or sidebar, as was a film called Antiviral, by Brandon Cronenberg. And if that name sounds familiar... That's David Cronenberg's son, and let me tell you, the apple does not fall too far from the tree on this one.
So it's a weird, strange, oddball movie.
Yes, it basically is the story of this character named Sid March who plays...
Did you see it?
I did see it, yes.
Uh-huh. Is it good?
It's not bad, but... it's not great.
David Cronenberg's son made an okay movie.
Yeah, and it takes place in this weird future, the near future where people are injecting themselves with the live viruses harvested from like six celebrities. So all these obsessed fans, you know, wind up getting like herpes from their big star.
Okay.
And it's, you know, a comment on, you know, the celebrity culture, obviously. And it's okay.
Let's not talk about a movie that's okay. Well, he's David Cronenberg's son. That's okay. Good for him.
Yeah, Cronenberg has a film here later called Cosmopolis. It shows, I believe, in a couple of days. Now,
that's very fun. That's got to be one of the first times a father and son have both separate films at the festival.
Right. But now, of course, everybody's focused on these competition films. So let's talk about first Ulrich Seidel's film Paradise Love. It's from Germany. This is about German women who travel to Kenya, where they are visiting a beach town, a resort town, and they're there to become sugar mamas to local boys. And that's, you know, for the local boys, that's their job. And this film, it kind of beats its point to death.
Tell me about what competition film you loved, because most of the films you see are not going to be that good. That's just the way of the world. Tell me about one that you loved.
Okay. Well, should we talk about the American films?
Tell me about your favorite movie of the festival so far, whatever it is.
I would say my favorite film and most people's favorite film is Amour by Michael Haneke. And of course,
Really?
Yeah, he won the Palme d'Or for The White Ribbon. This was, I think, in 2009.
And this is a far more, it's not accessible, but it is a far more sort of universal tale.
Yes. Well, it's certainly not a beat either. It's about two elderly people, one named George, one named Anne. They're in their 80s, and they're retired music teachers. And so it's kind of, in a way, a sequel to The Piano Teacher, maybe, which is another Haneke film. Isabelle Huppert stars as their daughter, and the wife in this relationship has a stroke. And it gets, I'm not giving anything away to tell you that the film opens and we see the dead body of the wife. I mean, it's like the first thing that happens in the film.
And then we flash back and find out how they got to that point.
Right. And it is a wonderfully touching and sentimental and well-crafted film about what it's like to grow old, the realities of growing old. And it's a phenomenally moving film.
And it stars Jean-Paul Trintignant. Am I saying that properly? Is that his name?
I believe so, yes.
Right. He was in Red, the great Kozlowski film. And he's a legendary French actor in many films. Bertolucci's The Conformist, I think, as well. So he's a major, major world talent. So if you're looking at movies that might come to play in the Oscars, elderly people dealing with death, a classic French actor and a great, you know, career capping performance. This is something that could come Oscar time.
If it's released this year, and that
or
is...
Or whenever it does, next year.
Yeah, this will definitely be nominated for Best Foreign Language Feature. I mean, it is really
good.
Oh, well,
good. No, then you can't say that, because the country has to nominate the film. So that's a entirely different issue. The country has to say, this is our film that we're putting up for possibility. So, you know, it may not get beyond the politics of his country, but I was suggesting the actor would be a potential for Best Actor, given the nature of the film and his legendary career.
Yes, it's a great movie and well worth seeing.
And that brings us to Rust and Bone, which people are also talking about. It's a potential Oscar hopeful for acting categories because of the people that star in it and their track record. This is the film by Jacques Audiard, who made A Prophet, one of my favorite films of 2 or 3 years ago. And it stars...
It stars Marianne Cotillard, who plays Stephanie, the lead character, as well as Matthias Schoenaerts, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and he plays Ali, the male lead.
And she's already won an Oscar for her performance as Edith Piaf, correct?
Yes, she's, you know, of course, La Vie en Rose, she won the Oscar, and, you know, she's a big star here in France, and she does a great job here as well, playing a double amputee. Again, not giving
any...
Again...
Well, a little bit away, though. It doesn't happen at the beginning, does it?
Not right away.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, she's a double. She trains killer whales at like an aquarium type place. Is that the idea, like a Sea World?
Yes, and it, very early in the film that occurs. It's not it's not halfway through the movie.
And is it a romance, a drama, a triumph over the odds film? What is it?
That's exactly what it is. It is a triumph over the odds. And I have to admit, I walked out of this film going, "Wow, that was a great movie," but when you first get to Cannes, you're a little, jet-lagged, and you maybe have taken an Ambien or two too many over, you know, too many days in a row. I can't remember a thing about the film. I'm going to have to see it all over again.
You got to take notes. Well, I know you told me that one of the funniest moments at a press conference surrounded the film The Angels Share by Ken Loach, who's a terrific British director who did The Wind That Shakes the Barley, among other films. And I know this movie is an interesting film that's a bit that has some adult language in it.
Yes, and I mean, I could play the clip here, I suppose, but the British screening board that basically said they had to remove some language from the film so that it could get a 15 in the UK, and the language that, well, let's just say it rhymes with punt.
Punt.
Punt, yeah, or hunt. So needless to say,
kids, cover your ears.
And so they, you know, they kept on the dais there where all of the actors and the filmmakers were speaking. They kept going back and forth saying, well, we only had to remove the bad, insert profane word here, not the good, insert.
Other bad uses of the word, like in a mean, nasty expression rather than just a simple reference to it?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Good Lord. Just kept saying the word over and over and over again. And now, you know, in France, I'm sure that's not a big problem. You know, you can air that on television, but, you know, in most of the world, you can't. So it was just kind of funny that for like a minute and a half to 2 minutes, they just kept saying the word. They probably said it more on the stage than they did in the movie.
So how was the film itself? Do you know?
The film itself, you know, people were positive. They really applauded and they were laughing and with it throughout the whole film. This is a film, you know, all of Ken Loach's films are very, they have some kind of social context to them. And this takes place in Glasgow, Scotland. It features a young actor who was not an actor before. He was actually in the juvenile, I don't want to say detention program, but it was, he was a part of the criminal system, if you will. And he was picked up by Ken Loach and Paul Laverty, Ken Loach's longtime screenwriter. And they cast it with all people like that. It's a story of this boy who gets put onto community service, meets three other people in community service, and they start to learn about whiskey. And they try to pull off a very interesting heist having to do with whiskey. It is very touching. It is very funny. It is well written. Of course, Paul Laverty is behind it, so that's not no surprise. It's not necessarily as heavy as many of the films here. So people were saying, you know, okay, yes, it was good, but, well, the but here, this is a film people should see. People will enjoy this film.
Ken Loach has never had a commercial hit in his entire career. Could this be the one?
This very well could be the one because it is as straight down the middle as you can get. It is, you know, somebody said, well, it was too predictable. I knew what was going to happen. And I said, yes, but it was still fun getting there.
What's been the most polarizing film at the festival so far? Is it perhaps Holy Motors?
I would say yes. I would say it is Holy Motors, although I don't know if you would call that polarizing since most people believe that this is the film by Leo Carax, who has not made a film in about 13 years.
His last movie was Pola X, correct?
Yes, and I think that was in the 1990s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 99.
And sure enough, he makes this film, and it is just bizarre beyond belief. And it features this guy named Oscar, and he rides around town, Paris, in a huge white limousine. And he's going to all of these appointments, one after the other. None of them seem to have anything to do with the next. And he is turning himself into these different characters inside the limousine going to the next appointment and then committing these weird acts, most of them murders. And he seems to be play-acting, but you have no idea why or what or if there's a camera anywhere. It doesn't really look like there's a camera anywhere. And it stars a whole bevy of different – I mean, Eva Mendes is in the film and Kylie Minogue is in the film.
Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it sci-fi? What is it?
It's everything. At one point, he's wearing a motion capture suit, and he does this huge dance with this other woman wearing a motion capture suit. And yet, the whole time I'm watching this movie, I'm thinking to myself, I should really, really hate this movie. There is no story here whatsoever. And yet, it is beautiful to look at, it is interesting to watch, and I don't want to leave because I want to know what the next scene is going to bring. Because you always think, somehow, they're going to like explain it. And in the end, it has this phenomenal last scene that features, well, I'm not going to say what it features, a phenomenal last scene, you know, the credits roll and people are on their feet applauding. And of course, there were one or two boos, but for the most part, this is the film that a lot of people believe is going to win the Palme d'Or so far.
Well, it's a little early yet, isn't it? It's still early days. We've got 5 days of competition still, right?
Yes, but I think, but 7 days behind you, you got more than a week behind you, so...
Yeah, you're starting to find out, but you can often find stuff on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We're not done yet.
That's right. A couple years ago, The Class won the Palme d'Or, and I think it screened on the last day.
Practically, yeah. I saw it and loved it. So that perhaps got the most applause of the movies you've heard so far from critics?
Absolutely. That got a lot of applause, as did The Angel's Share. The Angel's Share is, the title comes from the whiskey that evaporates through a barrel. They call that, you know, it's the whiskey, the angels.
So let's talk about some high profile American films. I guess the biggest just got reviewed. That's On the Road, the Walter Salles adaptation of the Jack Kerouac novel. The Jack Kerouac novel.
Yes. And that screened here today to be lots of hoopla, of course, because Kirsten Dunst is in it. Kristen Stewart is in it. You have a lot of stars. Viggo Mortensen was here to promote it as well. And it's an adaptation.
People were polite but not excited. That's the feeling I'm getting.
Flat. That's pretty much the, yeah. I mean, it's again, much like Leo Carrick's Holy Motors, it's, you know, the story is kind of existential in a way. It's got a lot more of a narrative than Holy Motors, but it was just flat. There was nothing really, it wasn't bad, it wasn't good, or great, I should say.
I've heard the same thing about Moonrise Kingdom, which was the opening night film. It's not in competition technically, I don't think. It's from director Wes Anderson and has his usual whimsy. And people say if you like Wes Anderson, you'll probably like Moonrise Kingdom. If you don't, this probably won't be the one to win you over.
Right. I mean, The Fantastic Mr. Fox is probably the only film that crossed over to non-Wes Anderson fans. But this is definitely not going to win you over. It stars Bill Murray, Bruce Willis, Frances McDormand. But the film really centers on two children who are about 12 years old. And it's in this make-believe world of the 1960s in what I assume is New England.
Did you like it?
You know, I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was great. You know, I laughed a bit, but I liked Wes Anderson's early movies. I haven't necessarily liked, you know, the submarine movie I thought was okay, not great. I mean, it's kind of hard not to like it, but it's you can't love it either.
Well, I'm sort of more interested in Lawless, which was written by the rocker Nick Cave, who's done a number of Westerns and films that he scored and worked on screenplays with. So this is not his first time at bat with a movie, but it's directed by John Hillcoat, and it's about Prohibition era gangsters, you know, rum runners. Back in, is it Virginia? Or I forget where they are. I think they're in Virginia.
Yes,
and
it is.
And it's got a starry cast, and I'm wondering how it is.
Yeah, it's based on the wettest county in the world. I almost said wettest country in the world, but which, by the way, France seems to be, at least this part of France seems to be this week. the wettest county in the world, which was written by Matthew Bondurant, and it's a true story about the Bondurant brothers, who, as you say, were bootleggers. Tom Hardy stars, and as does Shia LaBeouf. As is Jessica Chastain, and frankly, Shia LaBeouf is the weak link there, and unfortunately, the movie centers on his character mostly. Mia Wasikowska is in the film as his love interest, as Shia LaBeouf's love interest, and it's not a bad film, but there's no there.
Is it commercial or is it just flat? Is it wanting to be dramatic and serious and it just doesn't quite work? Or is it kind of fun? Will audiences like it? Because I've already seen a couple trailers.
It's not necessarily fun. It's very violent. And
I like violence. This is America.
Yeah, and it's actually, the violence is done quite interestingly. Now, Nick Cave and John Hillcoat, who directed the film, John, have worked together before. Nick Cave wrote The Proposition. And John Hillcoat directed with Guy Pearce, by the way, who does a fantastic job in this film. He, like, steals the show. His bad guy character in Lawless is really, I guess some people might say it goes overboard, but I kind of liked it. You know, it's just flat, really. That's the problem.
And then the movie that I'm really perhaps the most excited to see, and most sorry I'm not there
to catch. Let me guess, Killing Them Softly.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. This is a film by Andrew Dominik, the same filmmaker behind The Assassination of Jesse James. And this one is based on a novel, and it's...
I've already read it. It's called Kogan's Trade by George V. Higgins, and it's not a great novel, but it is filled with hilarious dialogue. And you read this book, and you go, the dialogue just pops off the screen, a la maybe Quentin Tarantino, and you just think, this is catnip for actors. I can't wait to hear some of these monologues and these bit of back and forth on a screen. So I hope the movie's funny.
Well, yes, it does have some funny moments. I don't necessarily know that it's a true comedy.
No, a black. It's not comedy, but it's very black humor, great distinctive dialogue, really character-defining dialogue that sticks with you, sharp, funny, memorable dialogue.
Yes, and it's very violent, but poetic violence. It's, you know, there's one scene in this where a character gets shot, and there's a car accident at the same time, and it's like ballet almost, the way this whole thing is choreographed. It's just, you know, glass shattering, the bullet going through the head. It's, you know, blood spurting everywhere, which
sounds like an American hit.
Yes, it sounds all very gross, but the, and by the way, is, but it also is done incredibly poetically. Again, there's nothing really to latch onto here because there's no character in the film, which stars Brad Pitt, by the way. And
right, basically, it's about people who knock over a gangster-protected poker game.
That's right.
And they knock over a poker game, and then the gangsters say, well, we can't allow that to stand. And Brad Pitt is brought in to clean up the mess.
Right, and by clean up, we mean, you know,
kill, 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 kill.
Right, and so you basically have Brad Pitt, who is, well, he's this assassin, so, you know, he's like the anti-hero. How do you like him? That's probably one of the flaws. And it was set in the, I think, 70s initially in the book, and here it's set on the eve of the 2008 election, and so it's got a lot of political, economic issues that are brought to the table.
Right. Crime is the business of America. That's sort of like a big tagline that pops out at people after they see the movie, something like that.
Yes. America is a business, not a country.
America is a business, not a country. Okay. All right. There you go. So how was the reaction to that in general?
You know, people, I think, liked it for the most part.
So what's been the biggest flop?
The biggest flop. I don't know. What would you say the biggest flop? Okay, so the person that you just heard is David Fear from Time Out New York. He's in the background here, and he just said that Confessions of a Child of the Century, which I know I just botched that title. I did hear that was horrible, so I didn't even pay attention to it. I didn't go see it. I don't know anything about it.
And what's the vibe overall? That it's a decent slate? It's okay? You're still waiting for some great movies? How's it going?
I think it's going okay. I think for the most part, it's a halfway decent slate. You know, there are films like the one from Egypt that just, you know, which was called After the Battle. It was a film by Yusri Nasrallah, which some people liked because it was set amidst the Arab Spring and, you know, literally set in the Arab Spring, in Tahrir Square. But frankly, it was just a whole lot of yelling. If you weren't from that culture, it didn't seem to make a lot of... It made sense, but it was hard to grasp. Abbas Kiarostami, who directed Certified Copy, has a film here called Like Someone in Love. That may be considered a huge disappointment for most of the people who were fans of Certified Copy a few years back at the festival, because this film does not stand up to that at all.
Well, and that film was a very unusual film in his body of work. Is this more like what he did in the past, more experimental, or is it another attempt at sort of a broader, more accessible movie and it falls flat?
I think the latter. It's you know, broader, more accessible, but it has no overall point the way Certified Copy does. Thomas Vinterberg has a film here that really split people. Some people really liked it, and other people hated it, and that was The Hunt. And it's about it's a Danish film, obviously, because he's from Denmark, the filmmaker. And it's about child molestation. And I don't mean that in a, because it really, there is no child molestation in it. It's
somebody who is accused of being a child molester and how just the suggestion of it poisons his life and the whole community against him.
Right. And it really is about the transformation of that character as he becomes a true man, so to speak.
Well, that sounds interesting. Did you like it?
I liked it, but you know, a lot of the people from the U.S. just thought it was horrible. They didn't like it at all because they felt, you know, the man didn't defend himself enough. And I think that there is a cultural difference there about the judicial system, which is not in the film at all, but just the way the culture responds to such allegations. And it's really about what happens when a lie goes wrong. And when people make the wrong decisions in how to handle a situation. So instead of trying to investigate this situation the proper way, all of a sudden the entire town knows, and it just kind of blows up into something that it isn't. And the same thing, actually, is true. The same kind of themes run through a film a lot of people loved, including myself, by a filmmaker who won the Palme d'Or several years ago named Christian Manju. Now, he won the Palme d'Or for 4 months, 3 days, something.
2 hours, 7 minutes, 4 seconds. He's the Romanian director.
Yes, and he has a film here called Beyond the Hills, and it is about two Romanian girls. One comes back from Germany to visit her friend, who happens to now be a nun. Now, the girls grew up in an orphanage together, and they were kind of, you know, had a little fling in the orphanage. And
hello.
The girl who comes back is madly, deeply in love with her friend.
Who is now a nun and married to God.
Correct. And it's kind of hard, if you're a suitor, if you're trying to compete with God as for affection, kind of hard.
It ain't easy.
Yeah, and it's all about what happens. It's about free will. It's about.
Is it long? Is it short? Is it slow moving?
It's slow moving, funny in parts, devastating. It's long, 2 hours and 30 minutes. Some say too long. Many say too long. And yet, that was the point. Much like a Catholic mass, some people say, oh my God, it just never ended. Well, guess what?
Oh,
that's the point behind.
No. The Catholics, we have short masses. And you go to the Baptists in the South, they have long services. We're like at 45 minutes, we're looking at our watch going, all right, time to wrap this puppy up. So and the Catholics do not have really long mass. That's the Protestants.
Okay, well.
We're tapping our time. If the priest is talking for 8 minutes, we're like, whoa. You know, when you go down South, those guys will talk for hours. And then you got the choirs. We don't do any of that.
Well, I will say that this is making statements on the Romanian orphanages and religion, of course. And it's a fascinating movie and well worth seeing, even though it may be a little too long for most people. It's a hard, it's not an easy film, but it ends quite well.
Sounds like a great quote to put on the poster. It's a hard film.
I'm not doing it any justice, and I realize that as I'm talking. I mean, unlike The
Hunt.
It's
a complicated, complex adult film.
Yes. But, you asked me, how's it going here? So today I saw a film called Post Tenebras Lux, and I know I just mispronounced that, but Carlos Regares, the Mexican filmmaker, made this film.
Who makes very severe, austere, difficult films.
To say this movie is difficult, there's nothing to grasp. It's about. No, I mean, I don't even know where to begin. It says, I'm going to read the tagline here, the synopsis that the festival gave. Juan and his urban family live in the Mexican countryside, where they enjoy and suffer a world apart. And nobody knows if these two worlds are complementary or if they strive to eliminate one another. And if you're confused after hearing that little synopsis, guess what? You'll be just as confused watching the film because it's like a dream state. It's very existential. There's like really no story at all.
It wouldn't be Khan if you didn't see a movie that was a complete head scratcher.
But you know what? It dawned on me watching this film. No hard narrative, kind of existential. Watching Leo Carrick's film, Holy Motors, same thing. On the Road, well, that was meant to be kind of rambling, and that was the whole point of that book. And how poetic it was. Some of these films, Beyond the Hills, which does have a narrative, but it's these long, chaotic moments. These are all films, these existential kind of borderless, they have no rules. They don't play within any kind of boundaries. And guess what? It's kind of like the world today. It's chaotic, and things are turned upside down.
People have always made rambling horrible movies, though.
Yeah, but I mean,
structureless rambling movies. I don't know if they reflect the age so much as just the directors who can't be bothered to give us a plot.
Well, but I mean, if you look at The Conversation, which showed here in I think 1974, 75, something like that.
The Coppola film?
The Coppola film, yes.
That's an incredibly focused plot-centric film.
Right, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is that the films that are shown in Cannes often reflect the state of the world for their time.
Well, I guess any movie or TV show or book is going to do that in some way.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe it's just kind of, inevitable that happens because people are living in the world today, so they're going to make a movie about the world today, and thus Cannes will show them, and it will, there will be these themes that are resonant for.
And a period film is always about the era in which it's made, not in the era in which it's set. But overall, what's the attendance like? Is it about the same as last year? Is it more? Is it less? Does it feel vibrant? Does this feel strong? How does it feel?
It feels strong. I think a lot of people this year are saying, wow, it's really expensive. we can't, some people didn't come. A lot of people didn't show up. A lot of the journalists didn't show up, but they still have 4,500 journalists here. It's really expensive this year, as always. It's the south of France.
Are you missing some people? There are people that you normally see that did not show up, or are the regulars that you know there?
Most of the regulars that I know are here. There's a couple of people from the Latin American countries that aren't here, one or two from Spain, obviously a few from Greece.
No one from Greece.
Yeah. There is a couple that I know from Greece.
I'm kidding.
And then there's this guy from the Huffington Post that didn't show up.
Yes, that would be me. That so is it a big deal that I'm not there? Or is it a big whoop? You don't really care. It's still Khan, even if I'm not there.
Okay, now I'm going to say it's a big deal because, you know, much like David Fear, who just walked through the room here, he's from Time Out New York. He's staying in the apartment along with myself and Stephen Garrett, who's writing for the New York Observer. And you know, Logan Hill from GQ. So there's all these, you know, people staying in this one apartment. Usually, Michael, you're a part of that, and you tell us how to use the washing machine. This year, I had to translate the French user manual for the washing machine and the dryer, and you tell us about all the good films to see because you've read all the books that they're based on. Well, this year, that's not the case. So we really are on our own this year in Shay Can here, and it has been a huge gap. And I'm not just saying that. We have actually commented numerous times that we're missing Michael because he would have told us whether to go see a certain movie or not.
Well, I'm glad to know that I'm missed. But that does bring us to Big Deal, Big Whoop, doesn't it?
That's true. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, actor Jim Parsons is gay. Shocker. Unless you live in Kansas and think Liberace was just waiting to meet the right girl, you know, this probably is no surprise to you, but it's still interesting on several levels. Now, Parsons is currently an Emmy-winning actor on one of the biggest hits on TV, CBS's The Big Bang Theory. He's starring on Broadway this summer in a revival of Harvey, the comic play that featured the everyman Jimmy Stewart in its film incarnation. And Parsons didn't even bother to be quoted in his own coming out. The New York Times mentioned it in passing in a lengthy profile of the actor. So it's official, I suppose, as low-key a manner as you can imagine. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal that he felt free to come out, and it's not a big deal, and people aren't all excited. That makes it a big deal. The fact that, you know, you've got a string now of actors in television and film that are coming out and getting on with their careers. And he didn't wait till after the show was over. He's still got a lot of opportunities in front of him. He's clearly not an action hero leading man type actor. So I don't think he was risking anything commercially. I think, it's a win-win for everybody. And we're still waiting for that action hero to come out, but it's great news. So I'm happy he decided to do it.
Well, you know, in the U.S., we have a president that supports gay marriage, and Brad Pitt here.
Most Americans.
Yeah. I mean, Brad Pitt here was asked by a foreign journalist, when is the wedding? When are you going to marry Angelina? And he said, well, we haven't set a date yet, and hopefully we will find and have marriage equality in the state of California before our date is set. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Of course, he's kind of come out in support of gay marriage in the past. Now, speaking of gay people, American Idol finalist Adam Lambert just topped the Billboard charts with his second album, Trespassing. That was my poor way of segueing, by the way.
So it's fine.
Okay. In a funny coincidence, he replaced former American Idol winner Carrie Underwood, whose new album drops to number 3. Lambert is the 7th Idol contestant to hit number 1 on the album chart, following Underwood, Kelly Clarkson, Ruben Studdard, Clay Aiken, Doherty, and Scott McCreery.
Daughtry.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Chris Daughtry.
My apologies, Mr. Daughtry.
That's okay.
That's the good news, though. The not so bad is that in this day of deflating album sales, Lambert topped the charts with a modest 77,000 copies sold. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal that he came out before his album hit number 1. That's never happened before, apparently. Elton John, George Michael, lots of stars have come out after they've had chart-topping hits, but none of them have topped the charts in the U.S. after coming out. Obviously, Clay Aiken came out after his album hit number 1. We've had other artists who people assumed were gay, like Luther Vandross, the late Luther Vandross, and Barry Manilow, who've all been on the top of the charts in the last decade. But none of them have come out and then hit number 1 until Adam Lambert. So historically, that seems to be the first time it's happened. You can look at people like David Bowie, who talked about being bisexual in the 70s. We've had members of rock bands talk about being bisexual, like one of the guys in Green Day and some other people. But for somebody, the lead singer, the main guy, to come out and then hit number 1, it's apparently never happened before, so congrats to him.
Are you telling me Barry Manilow is gay?
That's so we believe.
Okay, well, this next story I think is a big deal. NBC renewed the very low-rated sitcom Community. Now, that's not the story here. The story is they then bizarrely fired Dan Harmon, the creator and showrunner, even though it's a quirky series that springs entirely from his own mind. They also did the same thing with the struggling Broadway drama Smash, keeping the show on for a second season, but firing all the people that created it. And in fact, today they fired half the cast. Chevy Chase is happy about Community, but not many other people are. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because it's very bad for NBC. They're trying to rebuild themselves. They need to be friendly to talent. They need to encourage people to come to their network and take risks and bring shows to them and know that they can have freedom to do what they want, because that's what they need. They need a home run in order to get themselves back out of the cellar. And if they show themselves to be really anti-artist friendly, that's not going to help. And somebody said, you know why he was fired? The show's not a hit. And it's true. Your show's not a hit, never has been. But it's been on for 3 seasons. And if you want to show faith in it and bring it back for a fourth, firing him makes absolutely no sense. And they said, well, they want to get it to 100 episodes and they want to turn it into a hit. It's like, I'm sorry, it's 3 years old. It's not going to ever be a hit. So if they brought it back, nothing's going to magically change about this show and make it a top performer. Same thing with Smash. They're going to totally revamp the show. Okay, but they're firing the people who created it. It just is not a good move to make for NBC. They need to be artist friendly. And instead, they're telling artists, even if we renew your show, you're not going to be safe.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's a bit kind of a big deal. Now, the UK's biggest bookstore chain is partnering with Kindle. Waterstones, the largest bookstore chain in the UK, is teaming up with Amazon on its Kindle. They feel the need to have a stake in the digital world. If you aren't lined up with an e-reader, people will buy their e-books elsewhere. And Amazon knows the value of letting physical bookstores showcase titles that people can then purchase online. They said Kindle has a massive market share of digital book reading in the UK, and Waterston, I keep mispronouncing that, don't I?
Waterstones
will start to take a cut of it. However, for all its success, Amazon does not have a solution for discovery in physical or digital books that even comes close to the merchandising skills inside a branch of Waterstones. And this was said by Douglas McCabe from Ender's Analysis. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It just extends the Kindle around the world, gives Waterstones a foot in the digital world, but points out the desperate need for some way for people to discover new books without having to physically walk into a bookstore. Gosh. If only someone would create a website.
Interesting. How's that going? In any case, Good Morning America is becoming Good Morning Afternoon. The Today Show on NBC has slowly extended its reach to 7 days a week and many more hours than the 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. slot it used to occupy. Hot off beating Today in total viewers for the first time in 16 years, ABC rival Good Morning America is doing the same. GMA fixtures Laura Spencer and Josh Elliott will host a 9-week trial of Good Afternoon America later in the day, in the same time slot that Katie Couric's new talk show will occupy this fall. With ABC almost completely out of the soap opera game, they have a lot more space to fill, and GMA could be the perfect fit. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, that's a big whoop for in general, but, you know, extending the brand. I mean, Today Show is massively profitable for NBC. Good Morning America is on an upswing. It makes perfect sense now that they've trashed their entire lineup of soaps, and some of the shows that they put in place, like The Chew and Revolution, are not doing well at all. They're doing lower than the soaps were doing. Even though they're cheaper, they're failing. So taking Good Morning America and turning it into Good Afternoon and Good Evening America, hell, they'd probably run it 12 hours a day if it made money.
You heard it first on Showbiz Sandbox. The Broadway musical Priscilla, Queen of the Desert was holding on while the owners of the theater waited to see if they could snag the revival of Annie. Why let the house go dark until you have a new show ready to move in? So even though Priscilla was looking as tired as a drag queen on Monday morning, it stayed put.
I know you've been there, Sperling.
I almost say I was there this past Monday morning, in fact. But now Annie has chosen Priscilla's home, the Palace, I guess is the theater, where it will begin previews in October, and quicker than you can say, girl, it's over. Priscilla has been shown the door. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Annie is one of the hottest properties of the year. It's a big deal for Newsies, which is establishing itself into a genuine hit. It's selling out its shows. It's slowly increasing the prices. It's almost into that $1 million mark of making $1 million a week at the box office, and it's very much a Annie for boys with a lot of young kids selling newspapers. So Newsies is going to face a lot of fight for that family dollar when Annie's revival comes up in the fall, and they clearly want to establish themselves now and build a strong fan base so that they can hold off Annie when it shows up. You know, more than one show can flourish, but it's definitely going to be some competition for them.
Just days after the passing of pop diva Donna Summer, and oh, by the way, Robin Gibb as well, unfortunately.
Yes, yes, yes. I guess disco really has died now.
Well, that's a good point. I'm sorry for laughing, but timely statement there. Her iconic hit, I Feel Love, has been named one of 25 recordings to join the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. But the choice was made more than a month ago, long before most people realized Summer's health was fragile. Her tune joins the soundtrack to Purple Rain, the jazzy standard to TV's A Charlie Brown Christmas, Dolly Parton's childhood memory Coat of Many Colors, a Grateful Dead concert, Leonard Bernstein's last-minute debut as conductor with the New York Philharmonic, the only remaining recording of legendary stage performer Lillian Russell, and Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight. The first top...
I said a hip hop, a hibbity 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 hop, and you don't stop.
Right. Now, that's the first top 40 hip hop song. So, and you know, there's a bunch of others as well. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I am Wonder Mike, and I'd like to say hello. I think it's a big deal. I think it's, I like the National Recording Registry. I think they do a really good choice of keeping the mix interesting. There's nothing on here that seems bizarre or inappropriate. We've got a link to the Wikipedia entry for National Recording Registry. You can see all the stuff that they've chosen over the years. It's marginalia, like, you know, an early recording by Thomas Edison's people of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. You get all sorts of a range of stuff. I think it's a good cross-section of music. It's interesting. And certainly Donna Summer belongs in there. And it's nice to know that they had recognized her even before her passing.
Now, did Edison ever chart? I mean, did he top the charts when he released that?
Well, you're being funny, but no, he didn't. There were no charts. There were not enough. The recordings that they did, there were not enough stuff. But certainly the Edison Cylinders, you know, were a standard early on. And certainly I'm sure they had hits on the Edison Cylinders, but they didn't see them. They were just doing mostly test recordings.
Yes, I know. That was kind standards, of a joke. When you're making the world's first recording, the reality is you probably are charting because you have the only recording.
That's right.
Now, you know, actually, Leonard Bernstein's last-minute debut as a conductor, the importance there is that that's how he became the conductor of the New York Philharmonic. It was his first time conducting.
Right, somebody was ill and they just asked him to step in at the last second.
Right, and they went, "You did such a good job. Congratulations, you're hired."
That's right. So it's a real snapshot of a career. You know, you go out on stage and you come back a star. It's a real 42nd Street type magical moment.
Yes. And it's kind of a legendary story. But that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week's story is one that I picked out. It's certainly making the rounds here in Cannes, specifically because it deals with Cannes. And it's dealing with, but it goes a little bit beyond Cannes in a small way, and that is this idea of paying for celebrity interviews. And, you know, I guess technically what's been going on behind the scenes for years, it, certainly in Cannes and in Eastern European countries and Scandinavia, it goes on all year round, where distributors actually charge journalists for access to a film's stars. So the reason it happens here in Cannes, apparently, is because every distributor of a film has to nominate people from within their country. So if you're the distributor of Lawless or Killing Them Softly for...
When they're trying to fill up the slots, they've got 10,000 journalists, and they say, all right, for the 20 slots we have, we want this person, this person, this person, this person. Yeah, they say who they want to sit at the table.
That's right.
So from their country. So if you're from the U.S., the US PR people for the distributors say, okay, we want this guy from the Chicago, we want this guy from the New York Times, we want this person from the Daily News, this person from the Huffington Post, and so on. But they don't charge those journalists any pennies. I've never heard of this happening. I've never been asked for any money and never would. What happened here is that the distributor usually pays for it. It costs money to set up a round table. You've got a round table. You got to rent a space at a hotel. You got to have food. You got to have a thing, most of which I never touch, by the way. But it costs money to bring the people in, to set them around, to set them down. So they charge the different people around the world shoulder the cost of promoting the film. So
by people, we mean distributors. All these distributors, well, you know, the producer turns to the distributor and says, hey, it costs us $300,000 to put this press junket on.
So Sony Picture Classics will pay, you know, $8,000 or $15,000 or $27,000 to help shoulder the PR costs of the movie at Cannes. And what happened here is that somebody said, well, we're not going to pay for this because they're about to go into bankruptcy. But they said, well, we don't want to screw over the people in Canada just because we're not going to do it. So they said, hey, you know, if you want to go, you can pay $750 to sit at the round table, you know, with this actor and actress for On the Road, or sit at the TV interview for this people from Killing Them Softly. It'll cost you €3,000. So it wasn't like some It's not as if journalists have been having to write checks to sit down and do interviews. I've never heard of anyone doing that ever.
Actually, apparently, now that this has come to light, because Brian Johnson over at Maclean's Magazine in Canada was sent this kind of menu of options for these two films, On the Road and Killing Them Softly, both released by Alliance Films, and he made it public. As did Liam
Lacy.
And
when he published it, then they've banned him from the junket for the film.
Yes, exactly.
As if it's just his fault that they sent it to him.
Like, and they also, well, they banned him from Xavier Dolan's Lawrence Anyways, which they're also releasing, and Brandon Cronenberg's.
And that's a big thing because he's a Canadian, you know, talent. So that's a big film if you're from Canada that you want to cover.
Which Brandon Cronenberg is also from Canada, and they banned him from Antiviral. So
right, which is just stupid because he published something that they sent him.
Right, but I mean, for TV interviews for Killing Them Softly, all of a sudden I became Elmer Fudd here. Killing Them Softly, $3,200 to interview Brad Pitt. That's a lot of money.
So you're saying that journalists in other countries have now said, yes, we often write checks in order to sit at the table to do an interview.
Absolutely, yes. They have come out and said some of the Scandinavian journalists in Sweden and Finland. Certainly.
So the distributors don't pay it. They just say, hey, if you want to sit there, you're going to have to pay, you know, 20 kroner in order to sit at the table.
That's right, because there'll be like 10 journalists from Hungary, and I'm just picking a country out of the hat here. And they'll say, hey, look, you know, there's 10 of you. If you want to sit down with them, then you'll have to pay, you know, €1,000.
But no reputable journalist would do this from a reputable outlet.
And that's exactly the problem. It's that the people who wind up with access are the least reputable journalists around.
But they haven't stopped people from the U.S. and Canada and England and France and Germany and Spain getting access to people. They have been pushing aside the Times in order to give some schmuck with a $500 check a slot.
No, not at all. And frankly, the stars and the filmmakers don't know anything about this. And
they do now, though.
They do now because it was made very public here in this year in Cannes.
Well, is anything going to change? Are people going to say, hey, I don't want anybody paying to sit at the interview because I want the best outlet. I don't care who's going to pay what. I want the best outlet, not the outlet you can get a check from.
Well, you know,
because the outlet you can get a check from is going to be the sleazy outlet because a real outlet will not do that. It'll be against their policy. So Le Monde and any paper that you can name from around the world would absolutely have a policy against that. It would be illegal and it would not follow their journalistic practices. And therefore, you're preventing the stars from being seen at the best, smartest, most reputable outlets with the biggest reach.
Right. And that's exactly, I mean, they call it checkbook journalism. And as you say, no reputable outlet practices it. They shun it, in fact. But really.
So is anybody angry? Are they going to change this? Are stars going to speak out and complain? Are journalists asking them questions about this, saying, did you know about this? Are you going to insist this never be done again so that you can be speaking with the best journalists and not the sleaziest ones? What's going on?
I can't answer that because, you know, certainly it's the talk amongst journalists. But I think when you have Brad Pitt at your side and you have a few minutes with him, you're not going to be asking him about that because
if you're a good journalist, you will.
Well, I mean,
who wouldn't want to hear his quote on that? I would. It's not his fault. He didn't do it. He didn't know anything about it.
Well, right. But
it's
you have 5 minutes.
Right. So it's the NISS's news. That's what journalists do. But people were selling off interviews for Brad Pitt. Hey, you want to interview Brad Pitt? Give us 3,000 euros. I think I'd want to hear what Brad Pitt thinks about that. Don't you?
I kind of know what he would say. He would say,
I don't.
Hey, you know, I don't know anything about that. That's all something that happens. I certainly don't get the money.
You might say, I object to that. I'm going to make sure it never happens again.
And that's what Michael Moore said at Venice one year when he was told that some journalist had to pay 2,000 euros to speak with him. He was irate, and we didn't want the distributor to release the film.
Well, I think Brad Pitt could very well do the same thing. I think he should be asked that. And if there's a press conference or something, shame on you if you don't ask him.
Well, he either.
What are you going to ask him? Oh, tell me about your haircut and your new movie. You know, they asked him stupid things like, is the film Killing Them Softly a comment on Obama? It's like, no, it's not a rip against Obama. You stupid. Of course it's not.
No, they asked him when his wedding date was, actually.
Right. And those are the dumb journalists, aren't they?
Yeah, but I think really what this serves to underscore is kind of a running theme at this year's festival, or a running conversation.
That Sperling is for sale.
No. That it costs a lot of money to come to Cannes with a film, or just as a journalist to be here. So these outlets that send people here, it's a fortune. And
most outlets don't send people either. Most of the journalists I know go on their own dime.
And that's right. And that's absolutely where I was headed with that. And that really, a lot of the distributors are beginning to question whether it's worth coming at all. And what Alliance Films was saying was, hey,
well, they're going bankrupt.
Well, they're for sale. They're not going
right.
bankrupt.
Well, they're not doing anything. They have no funds. They can't spend money. You're telling me who said that they shouldn't bother going to Cannes anymore?
Well, there are lots of people. I mean, Sony.
Well, people question it every year. They say, "Oh, why do we come? Why do we come?" But there's no exodus
not,
to the
not,
door.
Not why do we come, but that the cost of coming has gone up substantially over the past 10 years to a point where the value that you get out of it, the return on investment, is quickly decreasing. And not just because, oh, gee, if you show a film in Cannes and it gets booed, it may not do well at the box office. But even if you do really well and people are standing on their feet and applauding, it costs so much money to be here that it's a wash. If not, you know, you're in the red when you leave. So as a studio and as a journalist.
Well, they don't gross money at Cannes. Right. They can't be in the red because, of course, every penny they spend, they're in the red. It's to promote a movie before it opens.
Right, but I'm saying
they would never be in the black after leaving Cannes. Of course, it's right. not possible. Is Cannes worth the promotional push for Europe? It's never been worth it for the U.S. It's not a good promotional platform for the U.S. It's a promotional platform for Europe and for Europeans. So should tons of U.S. people come here? No, they never really have. U.S. journalists are not coming the way they used to. I'm sure that'll go back down a little bit because there's no point for them to be there. You know, they can catch movies at Toronto. They can catch movies in the U.S. They don't need to be at Cannes. I go to Cannes because I love it and there's great movies, not because it's important to promote those movies in the U.S. It's a European platform for European movies.
Right. I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
Or for American movies in Europe. But I think it still has huge, huge presence in Europe. I think it's still a huge platform that gets tons of attention in the European press.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think, a lot of distributors from the U.S. and Latin America have questioned it, but I don't hear the same questions coming out of, say, the U.K. at all.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Well, so controversy at Cannes. If people want to send you money so that you can interview Brad Pitt, where do they send it, Sperling?
Actually, they could send a money order to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you could call us and leave us, your PIN number for your debit card.
That would be nice.
Yeah, the phone number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You know, you really could subscribe to the show as well in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or on Stitcher. And please do rate and review the show at those podcast aggregators. You can subscribe to the podcast via email. We'll send you an email every time we post an episode, or you can subscribe in your favorite podcatcher. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe and contact us, and even ways to follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter username is showbizsandbox, and we have a Facebook page. Believe it or not, it's showbizsandbox, so facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com.
And you can find them at Montreal in August, where they'll be at the Oceaga Music and Arts Festival. And then near my brother's hometown in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, they'll be there on August 5th for a performance. So see them live if you can.
And Michael Giltz, you have a website. It is?
MichaelGiltz.com.
And of course, some of your work can be found on the Huffington Post. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.